Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the APAHA for the privilege of the podium, but I do have a disclosure starting off. This has nothing to do with asthma, and in fact, I don't even mention the word asthma in my presentation, so if you're really here for something about asthma, I won't feel hurt if you feel compelled to leave. Nonetheless, I do think this is an important study, and I'd like to share with you the public health repercussions of metal mining in El Salvador, and this is a qualitative exploration we did from the University of Miami. And we have no financial relationships to disclose. But just to get started as a background, as you probably are all aware, heavy metal mining activity has increased throughout Latin America, and that's throughout Central South America. And that's largely because the demand in these precious metals has increased throughout the world, and so supply has matched that demand. Also, what we've been seeing since the mid-1990s and 2000s is there's a lessening of protectionist laws in various countries, and also more neoliberal trade agreements like the FTAA, NAFTA, CAFTA, et cetera, that make it easier to invest in these countries from foreign corporations. One example of the boldness of such foreign investments that we're seeing is I'd like to use the example of Pacific Rim from my home country, Canada, where they're actually they're exploring for gold mining in El Salvador, and because there's currently a moratorium in gold mining, they're suing the Salvadoran government, and it looks like they're successfully suing the Salvadoran government for $400 million for the denial of exploration of that gold. So it's the loss of potential profit, not even profit, and that's according to Salvadoran law. So it's making it easier to do metal mining. The pros for metal mining, of course, many people say this brings development and wealth and job creation to all these poor and low and middle income countries throughout the world. And the often mentioned con about that is there's significant and negative public health ramifications due to mining. So we wanted to look at El Salvador as a representative country in Latin America, and they've also had a recent increase in mining activity, as I've mentioned. But before we start talking about the nitty-gritty of mining in El Salvador, it's important to understand the history. And for anyone who's sort of something about the history of Latin America, it's, unfortunately, their history is not unique. There was a historic oligarchy in control of the government and the army for many decades. And there was an inability of the populace to bring about participatory democratic change through elections in the 1970s, which were largely viewed as fraudulent on two separate occasions. The population at that time, just like other countries in the region, turned towards the armed struggle. And that led to a U.S.-backed civil war from the 1980s to 1992. And just to give you an idea, similar to Guatemala and Nicaragua and many places in Latin America, you're talking about a population of slightly over 5 million in which 75,000 people were killed and 8,000 people disappeared. So we actually have not studied that trauma, but we think, and people are speculating, that that transgenerational transmission of trauma may make the population susceptible to new forms of violence. Faces not to forget. So what about mining in El Salvador? Well, since the end of the Civil War, foreign investment has been encouraged. There is a government that was elected, the Arena government, you may remember, that was very supportive of foreign investment, and mining was not excluded. However, people are finding in El Salvador that, you know what, maybe there are a lot of environmental ramifications because of this. And due to mining up in the mountainous regions in the departments or states, if you will, up in northern El Salvador, there's a river that's been contaminated because of previous metal mining that's been going on in the past, the San Sebastian River. And that's been found to have 9 times the limit of cyanide and over 1,000 times the limit of iron that's acceptable for human use. When polled, however, it's found that 70% of Salvadorans who actually live in mining areas do not support mining as an endeavor. And the largest concern that many Salvadorans are purportedly having is that they're concerned about the effects that this mining will have on future generations. However, as I mentioned, corporate persistence has taken many forms on anecdotal levels. There's definitely legal disputes on national and international trade levels, as well as reports of physical violence. So what was our question? Well, we actually did not have a question. In fact, we did reverse hypothesis engineering common to qualitative methodology, as I'm sure you're aware. And that's largely because we didn't have, there's not much data out there on metal mining in Latin America as a whole, let alone on El Salvador. Nor is there much data on the public health implications. There's few environmental and ecological studies. But also what was interesting for us is we didn't know what the effects of mining were specifically on a population that had suffered such a horrible history of violence and a civil war. So we wanted to explore perceptions and attitudes about mining, and we wanted to explore that from people who already had preconceived opinions and perceptions and attitudes about mining because they work in this area on a day-to-day basis. They're in environmental groups or different community groups or indigenous groups, human rights groups of different sorts, and want to ask for their opinion in particular. And so with the qualitative methodology, our sampling was combination criterion, purposive, and snowballing technique sample that was used so that people could identify other people that were vocal and active in that community. Our recruitment and procedures, as I mentioned, leaders of different organizations that were identified throughout El Salvador. And then we interviewed our leaders during April and May of 2013. So safety did become one issue, so we mainly interviewed people. Of course, it was voluntary and anonymous participation, and people could withdraw at any time. But largely, we interviewed people who were actually comfortable and sought out previous interviews with the media. They were comfortable speaking in international forums in different countries, so they were comfortable making their opinions and expressions heard. Excuse me. For data collection and analysis, that was done according to previously established methodology, nothing new there. And we used our semi-structured interview guide with the questions that were in place, but they were not written in stone. It was obviously an iterative process with refinements of the questions as we were going along. And what we did is, depending on the groups that were interviewed and the logistics of where we were interviewing, it was either a combination focus groups of between 4 to 7 or 8 participants, or individual interviews, depending on what was feasible at the time. And those interviews were recorded and transcribed until we actually achieved thematic saturation, where we heard no new ideas that were coming forth. And then we did our thematic analysis using grounded theory methodology, using a phenomenological process, manual coding of themes, and we organized these concepts to generate hypotheses. I think it's important to say that actually no pre-interview research was deliberately conducted on the topic so that the informants and participants could actually teach us about the ideas, but we were not going in with preconceived notions, we like to think. This is just a poster from Guatemala saying our customs are worth more than gold. So the results that we found, so the first theme that came forward was the false promise of development, one question about that. And again, in total, we had 32 participants in focus groups and 11 individual interviews. So, but just to explain what was meant by the fallacy of economic development, it was interesting that no one actually supported the notion that mining would be a path to development on a national level, largely because it's an activity that's deemed to be unsustainable, so it won't actually continue to support the economy, but the reverse actually is going to be a burden on the economy and detriment due to El Salvador due to the environmental degradation and cleanup and health effects that the Salvadoran government will have to pay for. Also, there's the fallacy of job creation and economic growth, and that's largely felt that all the plush jobs, if you will, or the best high-paying jobs that were more of a permanent nature would be reserved for foreign technicians and engineers and people that really do not have that training locally in El Salvador. Certainly there would be manual labor positions available to Salvadorans, but these would be precarious labor and certainly high risk and dangerous, and also very temporary. The other thing, public land development would need to be undertaken, and that's, for example, roads will need to be built and paved in order to bring the machinery towards the mines, and it would be the Salvadoran people and government to pay for that, to support that. So again, the fallacy of national development. Well, what about paying corporate income tax? Wouldn't that help the Salvadorans ultimately? A lot of the Salvadorans felt that the 2% corporate tax rate would be still too low to offset any environmental and public health degradation. And in fact, there's so many tax shelters as there are, that it's typically a 0% corporate tax rate that is paid. And again, regional trade laws, and in fact, ironically, national Salvadoran trade laws favor rich foreign corporations over the local Salvadoran rights. So we explored also the negative effects of mining. What were the perceptions on that? And there are two large themes that came out. One was environmental and one was more of a public health effect. So from an environmental effect, certainly what resonated strongly was this notion of estrés hídrico, or this water stress, meaning that there's only 3% of El Salvador's surface water that's available for human consumption. And mining is an exquisite threat to the aquifer. So this was a huge concern for people, largely because you need massive volumes of water in order to do the mining, but also you're worried about contamination of the water by tailings. Also, chemical exposure. There is concern about the release in particular of arsenic into the environment. And also concern that in El Salvador, they weren't really equipped to test water and test air appropriately to measure actually levels of arsenic on a grand level. For direct health effects, there were definitely concerns for both not just humans, but also the animal populations and livestock populations. And people were giving anecdotal references to neurologic defects like Guillain-Barré syndrome, dermatologic conditions, and hematologic cancers that people were witnessing both in humans and livestock. And what's very concerning also is El Salvador has a huge population density. It's extremely dense, so if there is some sort of metal mining disaster, then that has incredible ramifications for the local population and the entire nation, actually. Different from a country like one I come from Canada, where you can do mining activities up north and the population density may be a lot lower. So another theme that came forth, which was fascinating on a personal level, was hearing about the mining-generated violence and the parallels to the Civil War that people remember very recently. So it was mentioned from time to time that the Civil War was definitely supported by a lot of external forces, and these are forces that threatened the country's autonomy and had extreme and direct ramifications on the population's well-being. And many people are saying that's analogous to what we're seeing with foreign mining corporations coming in and dictating to us what's going to happen with our public health and with our land and our water and our air. But what was actually more shocking was the reports of direct violence, and those included threats, torture, and assassinations. And these are actually, going back now after doing the study, well documented. So death threats are very common against, quote, anti-mining activists or anyone that sort of puts roadblocks in front of mining activities. Torture and assassinations have occurred. There were reports of this in northern areas with increased mining activities. Displacement of populations also. Threats and bribes were used to internally displace people off mineral-rich land. That was not uncommon, and that was actually very similar to internally displaced populations that were seen during the Civil War. What was also particularly troubling were the social divisions. These were encouraged by mining corporations, leading to the erosion of community cohesion. There were cases of corporations paying brothers within families to divide, paying off religious figures within small towns and communities to sow a lot of division within families along ideologic lines. And then there was also structural violence. And this was a recurrent theme that we heard over and over again about a war of exclusion, that similar to the time of the Civil War, it's felt that there are structures in place that would automatically favor the foreign mining company over the rights of the poor Salvadoran campesino. that was felt to be similar as in the past. When we found Marcelo's body, that was hard. That was very hard. His fingernails had been pulled out, and his hand had been shoved into his mouth. His genitalia had signs of torture. Forensically speaking, this was the same pattern of torture used by the death squads during the Civil War. The sole purpose is to intimidate the community. And this was one of our interviewees, who happens to be a lawyer, in reference to the torture and disappearance of Marcelo Rivera in 2009. And unfortunately, he's not the only one. So what of the solutions? It's quite interesting because people were mentioning that there are a lot of local economic initiatives that were ongoing. There was strengthening of, interestingly, nonpartisan popular power and also supporting national autonomy to have a stronger economic decision-making ability. So cooperatives, there were a lot of cooperatives on the ground, and many Salvadorans were pointing to these as a way to avoid having to work in the mines to survive economically. And it was the sense of community through economic activity, where the cohesiveness of learning how to run a cooperative together, whether it was through fishing or even cashew industry, was very interesting. And actually, with increased economic activity, that gave purchasing power to local communities where they could actually have further control over the lands. And what was interesting is sometimes they would have control over the lands and mineral-rich lands. They would actually convert into religious areas so that mining would now be forbidden, because you can't mine a site that's deemed to be religious or have some sort of religious significance. And all of this increased control over the lands on a local level and control over the economic activity actually led to increased participatory democracy, people felt, leading to more community-based solutions. So limitations, these limitations are common to qualitative methodologies, is we can't really verify the reports either on the environmental or health effects or even the reports of violence. But again, that's not the purpose of these interviews. It wasn't to authenticate any of the facts, but just to get the opinions and perceptions of what people felt to be as important. Something that was personally kind of troubling is we actually had no female interviewees, and as luck would have it, during the time of the conference, there was a sort of a long-standing conference going on in Haiti on gender and the environment regionally, so many of the women that were very involved in local community organizations were actually at this one conference. But that can certainly change the perspective, perhaps, or maybe we're missing out on certain themes that would have emerged. We do have the attitudes and perceptions of a narrow sample on purpose, because these people deal with mining and mining issues on a day-to-day basis. However, you can't necessarily extrapolate that to the general population and say this is how all Salvadorans feel about mining. But again, I think it is important. This is a perspective we deliberately sought. And also many of the people that are very active in mining issues. The feeling, however, we never sought this information specifically as part of our demographics. Certainly some of the people that were participants probably were survivors of the Civil War and were probably active either, likely on the side of the guerrilla or the FMLN, or they were very active in the Civil War at that time. Some of them, it's purported that they were. So they actually may have a very different political ideology or formation compared to other Salvadorans that were not in the war or not as active in the war. So in conclusion, the impact of metal mining is much broader than the direct health or environmental effects one would consider. And what was interesting is we found similarities between mining and the Civil War. There do not seem to be any provided apparent economic or developmental benefits in allowing large-scale metal mining activities to continue. If anything, Salvadorans feel, or the ones we interviewed, that this creates an economic burden, little return on investment, false hope of stable employment, etc. So solutions are being developed on a community level based on democratic economic activity like cooperatives. And the ensuing economic empowerment, I think, is very interesting in terms of having further control over the land, but leading to greater participatory democracy, strengthening national autonomy. And it led us to actually come up with this theoretical model where you have a Venn-type diagram where you have similarities and differences between the Civil War and metal mining, where similar to both is you have external influences that may weaken autonomous institutions with foreigners telling the government what they should or should not do and using financial or physical coercion. On an economic level, the differences were during the Civil War, there was a huge economic boost to the Salvadoran government where they were receiving $1 million a day during the time of Reagan, whereas metal mining was certainly an economic burden on the country with a stress on the public system on a variety of levels I highlighted. From a health level, the differences, again, is you had bombing, a scorched earth policy, and direct violence on that level versus more of a water contamination and toxic exposure for metal mining. But certainly that violence, unfortunately, we're seeing similarities that persist to this day. And for solutions, you had democratic areas, perhaps, or people or autonomously controlled areas during the war that would have been considered guerrilla-controlled territories that were safe for displaced populations. And during the time of metal mining, you have community cooperatives and economic independence from mining, which it's hoped will lead to communities of resistance that are more based on participatory democracy. So we created hypotheses talking about how the effects of metal mining go beyond environmental effects because of the history of war, and that the resistance actually leads to more of a participatory democratic process. And I think there are many things to think about for future directions in terms of we do need those ecological studies to confirm what people are saying. Definitely need mental health studies to explore the effects of mining, generated violence in a post-traumatized and post-war population. But also I think very importantly is we need to recognize how these corporate activities from countries in the north actually threaten the autonomy of sovereign governments. And it's reported, what came up a lot as well was that the feeling is that the coup d'etat, which was considered illegal against Zelaya in Honduras in 2007, occurred right after he passed a series of legislative changes that made it more difficult for mining activity to occur. It's similar to the Canadian government sending out our NSA equivalent to spy on the Brazilian government on behalf of our mining corporations, as was released recently in October. So it's important to support and recognize communities of resistance engaged in these forms of participatory democracy, because it actually strengthens the national government to make their decisions for their populations. And I feel it's a model for ongoing democratization of Latin America. And I'd like to thank you very much for your attention. And I have several acknowledgments. And I'm happy to, with my excellent co-panelists, entertain any questions you may have. Thank you very much.